Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Charles Harrington has been reading, teaching, and loving tarot for 25 years. He is the author of the guidebooks to The Murder of Crows Tarot, The Ferenc Pinter Tarot, and Tarot V from Lo Scarabeo. His love of the cards and connecting with other readers has manifested in co-hosting podcasts, speaking at conferences, and leading meetups in the San Francisco Bay Area. In his free time, he loves to find new and strange ways to use the cards in pursuit of wisdom, fun, and the occasional free cocktail. Charles Harrington, welcome to Witchlit.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I feel like I should say welcome to Witchlit neighbor.
Yes, we're the rare Californians who found each other.
Yes, exactly. So I can't wait to talk to you about tarot and vampires and writing and all that good stuff. But our first question for everybody is, you know, in this age of video and all of, you know, audiobook, you know, whatever, like, why still write books? Why still write?
Oh, absolutely. I've been thinking about this question a lot because I've really enjoyed the your podcast. And I think that So people who love books, like, it goes beyond just the content or the story. And I love an audiobook. I've learned to like ebooks, but the smell of books is wonderful. And also, when it comes to tarot decks, since I get to work in the world of tarot, there are digital options. There's all kinds of, the future is bright for what people can do with technology, but like having the cards, like the more you use the cards, the more that deck becomes yours. Having that physical experience is just, it is something else. And also, I think sometimes every tarot reader has to ask himself, like, or tarot deck creator has to ask himself, like, okay, how am I improving beyond the Rider-Waite-Smith? Like, or else why do this? And I think that the answer is that people love new ideas and new decks, and they each deck is somebody's first and somebody's favorite.
Yeah. Oh, so what drew you to tarot? What brought you into the world of tarot cards?
Like many of your guests, I was a weird kid in high school. I grew up in a Lutheran kind of vaguely Lutheran house, and I also went to a Baptist junior high, so I was aware of Wicca, but I thought I wasn't allowed to do that. I didn't like, I thought they were fun. They were, it seemed like nice people, but I wasn't allowed. And tarot seemed like a nice little gateway to all of that. It seemed a little safer. And there's Austin's, I found a Christian guidebook to tarot when I was young, and I found that really helpful. And I took my deck to school every day, and I would do readings for people, you know, between classes, during classes. And I just kept, you know, just doing it just with the little white book, the LWB, which I'm sure we'll get into those. But then in like college, I kind of got religion around tarot and started studying like Mary Kay Greer, Rachel Pollack, and others. And I've never stopped learning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like tarot is one of those things you definitely can dedicate your life to. I mean,
absolutely. I think it's all of these pursuits, like there's more to learn, but it's also just because every reading is different, you know, you get like, when you get different questions, that opens up kind of new design space, if it is the weird word to use, in your brain for what the cards mean. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And I think we're also getting to see lots of new perspectives on tarot. So we're sort of thinking like mindfulness and self-care and things like that kind of show up in that world. So there's more and more and more every year.
So how did you go from tarot reader to tarot deck author, you know, being involved with deck creation? Like how did you make that leap?
So it's funny. I have people, so when you've been reading tarot a certain number of years, you always get the question, like, would you make your own deck? And I think there were a period of time in the early 2000s that was sort of like every tarot reader has to have their own collage deck that they've made, you know, with their own ideas. And I had no interest because I just didn't have like a unified theory of the universe that needed to exist. And I was emailing a friend. I made friends with Barbara Moore, who's a tarot editor at over at Llewellyn. And we were over the show, The Magicians. That's how we became friends. We both love the show, The Magicians. We email each other after every episode. And she shared a tarot card from a deck. And I like thought it was really interesting. So I wrote like kind of like a really long kind of response back about what I thought was going on. And she sent a one sentence reply, which was, have you ever thought about writing a tarot deck or creating a tarot deck? And I wrote back, oh no, I don't have this like grand, beautiful theory of occultism that would change the world. And she said, oh, that's not what we want. We would either want someone to do a cat tarot or a vampire tarot, which that's an amazing answer. And in that moment, I was like, oh, I could do a vampire tarot. I know from vampires. And I, there's vampire. And one of the jokes used to be like another vampire deck. There's like, I don't know, maybe five or six main ones that people think of. And I remember so the question for me was like, what hasn't been done? And I had attended at Pantheacon, which is a pagan conference here in California that used to exist. The late, great Margot Adler gave a talk. And it was such a weird thing on the program. It was like about vampires. I mean, Margot Adler, like the author of Drawing Down the Moon, is talking about vampires. So I went to that, and she, when her late husband passed away unexpectedly, she coped with that by reading hundreds of vampire books, like novels. Like I think it's over 300 in just a few years, like a staggering amount of vampire novels. And she kind of came up with this theory that I thought was fascinating, which was her sort of theory of the moral vampire, which anything post, a lot of vampire fiction post Dark Shadows with Barnabas Collins, but like The Interview with the Vampire, Buffy, we start to have vampire as hero instead of just monster antagonist. The moral vampire is a person who it realizes that they're very powerful, but they're very dangerous and they want to live a moral life. And so you get like Angel on Buffy, who's very dangerous and but was trying to use his powers for good. And that's a great metaphor for us today, modern humans. There's a lot we can do. It's very easy for us to fulfill our desires, but we have to be careful and we want to be good about it and not hurt others. So I thought that was a brilliant way to marry sort of, well, vampires writ large, but also specifically what I also believed hadn't been done was a really great deck for modern vampire fiction. Most vampire decks were very much like the Carpathian sort of shrouded rooms and castles and women in bodices kinds of tarot decks, and they're fabulous, but they didn't do the sort of urban fantasy modern thing. We think of like TV shows like True Blood, Discovery of Witches, that kind of thing. All of them, and Vampire Diaries, all of them. That deck hadn't been created yet. So here was my lane. This was like, so I wrote that pitch and it got accepted. And then once it got accepted, bizarrely, before Tarot of the Vampires came out, that was my first pitch. And then I got to write three other guidebooks because Los Scarabeo found out about me from Barbara, and they had me write for them. So it went from like, I'm never going to do this, to like, I've now written like five or six guidebooks.
And two vampire themed ones.
Two vampire, you know, it's funny. I felt like if this is my magnum opus, and then Los Scarabeo, their second deck for me was Tarot V, which is a very sequel. Tarot Z was a zombie deck. Tarot V is like horror movie vampire with a more like Nosferatu with the dripping and the blood and the kind of like more goth and twisted, more goth. All vampire stuff's pretty goth. But so I wrote back and I said like, oh, Llewellyn and Los Caribbean, I'm like, I don't think I can do this other guidebook because I'm already doing this vampire deck. And I'm like, oh no, these are so different. And so to make that one different, what I got to do, the first Tarot Z, the great Jamie Alford wrote the guidebook as a manual for zombie slayers or survivors of like the zombie apocalypse. So if you, okay, every time you write a tarot guidebook, it has to be different somehow to fit that deck. So I had the idea of, and I'll come in for a landing on this. The guidebook is written from a very arch and sardonic vampire sire to their new progeny with little flavor text about different beings and different ways of being in the vampire world. If that makes any sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense. And, well, and one of the things I like about Terror of the Vampires is that it is also telling a story about, like, a, you know, the fool is actually this young woman who kind of waltzes into the world of vampires on a date, kind of.
Yeah. I wanted to tell, like, a light story throughout the major, not every major has her story in it, but I wanted to sort of go from a lot of the things in the deck are trying to show, like, especially because vampire fiction does this, where do you start and how does it end? So the fool, she goes on a journey. She meets this very attractive dark gentleman, and gains her entry into this world of vampires, becomes a vampire, and then slays her oppressor and is balancing her vampire and mortal sides by the end the world card. And then all of the twos pay off in the tens is my other wacky theory in the deck. So there's like a little bit of storytelling, but also plenty of other one-off moments for people to enjoy.
Yeah. So how closely did you work with the illustrator? Like how has that been for you, like working with the illustrator and writing the book?
Oh, it was so for Terror of the Vampires, it was incredible because I got to work with him. For some of the other decks, you receive an art file that's complete, right? And like you write the deck. You know, so you write the guidebook for that's why my Illuscarabea decks usually go. And That's a different skill, and that's you're like, okay, this is the star, you know. So for vampires, just to like show how the sausage is made a little bit, the person who wants to write, if you're listening to this and you have a tarot deck idea, here's what you have to do. So you have to figure out what all 78 cards are, and then you have to write like a light script for each of them. So for example, the fool in a park at night, young woman meets a vampire. He's holding a rose. She's holding a lily, whatever. And then, so then they look at your ideas and Llewellyn starts looking at for artists. And I was brought into that process and I got to see some art and quickly found Craig Marr, who does incredible work. And for me, it was important to work with him because he does very diverse characters. He had done vampire art, but he'd done really diverse art because sometimes in tarot deck there's this phenomenon I call like same face. I think other people call it same face, where every woman has the same face and every man. Yeah. So he did these diverse people, and he could also drew animals and full scenes, which is like a trifecta, and it's very hard. So then, okay, so now Craig's on the project. He sees the script, and then card by card, four cards at a time, I would rewrite each of the card scripts very fully, you know, absolutely like everything I had in mind. And then Craig would do his version. And here's what I learned about this process, about writing it. Because like, I guess I imagined like, I knew it would be different than I thought, but you just sort of seem like, okay, I will write this and you'll draw that. You'll take the thing in my head and make it real. And I learned so much from that. One is that I think in horizontal images. I think in scenes, and an artist like Craig was able to frame everything to tell a story vertically and get these elements in. So a couple of things, he would send like four thumbnails, like black and white, like kind of rough sketches of concepts, three or four for each card, and I would pick one for him to explore more or to move forward with. And I would have some notes, but a lot of things in the deck are completely Craig's idea. Just as an example, in the fool card, we see her and the mysterious guy. And I had written in the script, like there's a, that the other figure who's holding a rose is in complete shadow. You can't see him. And Craig put him completely in the foreground, which is smart because if the card showed a woman like going away with a dark stranger we can't see, the reader would be like, well, don't do that. That's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
But when you see him, you're like, oh, I get it. She's got to go with him. So it's collaborative. And he and I would connect back and forth. And he's such a phenomenal artist. And a lot of the elements like he would bring in that weren't even in my writing, or he would actually change a scene. And it was always the right call. So it was very collaborative as opposed to, you know, receiving the file.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned kind of like the urban fantasy vampire, because that's the artwork reminds me of like urban fantasy covers.
Mm-hmm.
Like it has that kind of, I don't know, there's almost like a blueness, like the mm-hmm. color, not like porn.
Like yeah. Yeah.
Blueness to the, that genre, like blues mm-hmm. and purples. And I think like the darkness of the art in the deck, it's actually quite colorful and bright, mm-hmm. but there is a lot of like dark blue and dark purple and black tones in it. So it kind of has that urban fantasy cover idea. And then like a lot of the characters, they are really diverse and they're like gender diverse as well. Mm-hmm. Like they're, you know, some of like, I like that how you said in the early part of the book, like, you know, the king, the queen, you know, these are suggestions. These are not, mm-hmm. you know, this doesn't mean this is a person who identifies and presents as male, you know, mm-hmm. that's not what this is about. And, but it shows up in the cards too, because I think the page and knights are reversed in kind of what gender they present as yeah. in different suits. And yeah, it's just, it is very modern feeling and very urban fantasy vampire feeling.
Absolutely. I think, I think every deck set in with a modern setting has to be diverse today, but, and should be, but also that's a true reflection of urban fantasy in that, mm-hmm. Both the books, you know, there's a lot more racial diversity, but also, in the movies, I was just thinking in the last 2 years, there've been like a couple really big vampire movies, and they've all had non-white lead characters somewhere in there. The Invitation, so amazing. And it explores race issues and gender issues. And then mm-hmm. Voyage of the Demeter, they totally bury the lead, but the lead is a black man. And that is not shown in the trailer, really. So one, that should reflect that. But two, it's with vampires, they play with gender. If you live to be forever, yeah. you'd have fun with that. But also, okay, one wacky thing. And of course there's LGBTQ characters in it. And there are certain things like the Two of Swords. When I saw that card, I'd written it as like Latina vampire hunter. And I think I sent like a photo to Craig of a suggestion of place to start. And when he drew the person, I was like, this person's non-binary. That wasn't the intention, mm-hmm. but I was like, one, I think this person just seems really non-binary. Two, like they should be in the deck. There should be non-binary people. I just know how to do that. Now I know. And three, like, the Two of Swords would be a great place just metaphorically for not, and I hope this doesn't offend any non-binary people. And if it does, like, please send me on Twitter. But I thought the Two of Swords with that sort of balance between forces would be a mm-hmm. great place for a non-binary person. So then I also had them appear again as Justice, which is another like that balance thing. And also in the Judgment card.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you get to like, with vampires, it's kind of fun. Like if you put two men, two women together, they might be a snack. They might be a date. Who can say?
Yes. Well, and I think that, you know, I mean, like, especially when you're talking about like vampires in modern media, I mean, like from the Anne Rice vampires on, vampires are really sexually and gender fluid. I mean, that's just yes. kind of how they are written in more modern texts. Well, until you get to Twilight, and that's a whole different story. But.
Gosh, the funny thing about Twilight, I will just say, is that like, when I saw the first one, I didn't really hear like the cultural thing about it. I didn't read the books, but I kind of felt like this isn't kind of my thing, but it seems like fine. And then like the degree to which like certain men hated it so much, it made me kind of be like be on its side a little bit. Anyway, there was a card that was very explicitly for Twilight in the book, and then I moved it out because I found it better. I bet it became the Nine of Cups was going to be like a vampire prom, and it became Elizabeth Bathory bathing in a bathtub full of blood, which is a pretty strong about face, I think. But anyway,
that's pretty different. That's pretty different direction. Yeah.
Sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
That's okay.
Yeah,
it's all good. So I did ask you kind of how you got into Tarot, mm-hmm. but I didn't ask you how you got into vampires.
Yeah. Oh man. Since the beginning. Okay. I was always. I think this is probably true of a lot of people in this world. Is Halloween as a kid, super into Halloween, and I definitely was always into like Dracula at a very early age. He's very stately and cool. And I remember when the Gary Oldman movie came out when I was a kid and I wasn't allowed to see it, which made it seem even cooler. the Bram Stoker's Dracula and
that movie. Mm.
Yeah. I don't know. I enjoy it still. I'm sure, you know, it's so definitely a vampire, especially when Buffy the Vampire Slayer hit when I was in high school. Oh man, that show was like just the truth for me at that time in my life. So I've always had this a great thing for vampires, and they're I've heard it said they're the one monster people want to actually be. Being a werewolf is like really rough, you know, and being a zombie seems like really like a real smelly kind of way to be. So vampires have this life, and I think that they make you think about like, what would I do? Mm-hmm. Like, what would I do if I had this? Like, would I do it? You know, would I become, what would you become eternal? But then you know, you can't go out during the day. All these things are fun questions to ask.
Yeah. I remember watching the Gary Oldman movie. It came out when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And he's a snack in that movie.
Yeah,
like Gary Oldman is beautiful in that movie.
I have crossed oceans of time to find you.
Yes. And like all of the goth boys I knew were like immediately in tiny round blue sunglasses.
Yes.
And I also did LARPing. I played Masquerade in college.
I played it as well.
Yeah. So vampires kind of, and I mean, I read Anne Rice when I was in high school. So it started with Anne.
The thing, oh, I love Anne Rice. And I think the other thing about, okay, so the vampire is like the cultural shadow. We kind of get that into the book. Most monsters kind of are, but vampires are great as cultural shadows. And so one of the reasons sort of that gender variance shows up in vampires is because it's a taboo for our culture, mm-hmm. for men to be feminine, for women to be dangerous. You know, it's like this is a taboo. Yeah. So vampires are, they display that for us, for good or bad, however you feel about that. But like things like the shadow, vampires have explored our shadows of like mental health, you know, sexuality, drug use, disease, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're like, I don't know. It's just really easy to lay a metaphor on vampirism of some sort.
Oh, yes.
I mean, werewolves do a little bit, but I think vampires work better. And like you said, vampires are sexier than werewolves. Sorry.
Twilight. Yeah, if you're listening, if you're like a Teen Wolf stan, absolutely. Like, I get it. I'm learning that world. That's a different world. It's a more like a feral approach to the world. They like they're more instinctual. Vampires are like culture upon culture kind of thing. And mm-hmm. so, I did put one werewolf in the deck though, and think werewolves are so hard to draw that I poor Craig. okay, something I learned about writing. For this, I would sometimes I would have a concept for a card, and I would be like, but how would you do that? One of them is the strength card is based on the idea that vampires are struggling with their hunger. Like you can't let your hunger sabotage you if you're gonna not be just a monster. And so I had this idea of like a stylized lion made of blood in the woman's chest. And I remember asking Barbara, my editor, I'm like, well, but how would Craig, would anyone do that? Is it too weird a concept? And she's like, he's the illustrator. That's what his job is. Like, that's his skill. And don't you worry about it. And also don't put limitations on it that are going to get in his way. So as the writer for a tarot deck, if you have an illustrator, like I would never have come up with exactly the image that he created for that card, which was really powerful.
It is.
And then same thing with the four of wands, which is a vampire in a club, and we're seeing the hearts and the veins of all of the club goers. I remember being like, how do you do this? Good luck, Craig. but that's he has that skill that I don't have, like visual setting the scene perfectly in this frame kind of thing, if that makes any sense.
No, and that card, the strength card, is really one of like going, just when I opened the deck, I was just kind of flipping through. I was like, wow, these are. And that was one of the ones that really that stuck. You. One of the images that stuck with me. So good job, both of you. So like literary vampires, I mean, you know, if we're talking about like current vampires in like the history of vampires from Bram Stoker. So what is your like, this is the pinnacle vampire story for you.
So here's what, so whenever I ask anyone what their favorite vampire thing is, the first thing they say is like, well, it's cheesy. And I was like, it's really okay. You know, literary vampires, I guess I just, Dracula did so much, but to me, The Vampire Chronicles is, you can just get lost in that world. In I haven't read all, I believe there's like 18 books in there, but it is just, you can get really lost in the thoughts of these characters, and their introspection makes you do introspection. Mm-hmm. And for me, that is so, like, my first answer is there, but then I want to zag. I really love Bloodsucking Fiends by Christopher Moore, which is a comedy romance set in San Francisco. And for me, the Four of Wands is my tribute to Jodi from that. And the moment that she realizes, like, she spent her whole life being afraid and, like, being at, like, other people's mercy. And there's just a moment in the book where she's like, oh, I've had it with that. Like, this is, and she's actually in a club in an LBD, you know, dress. And, but just this moment of, and throughout, it's a trilogy. It's a really good little trilogy. There's like a divergence. Her human love turns into a vampire as well, like wants to be human again. And she wants to be a vampire. And it's these two, she embraces the gift in a way that he can't. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh no, totally makes sense. Yeah. No, I like that. Well, and I think, you know, if you're into vampire literature, mm-hmm. like,
yes,
there's such a breadth. Like, there are things like Christopher Moore, like mm-hmm. the comedy aspect of it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and there's like those like weird exploitation films from the 80s of like, yes. like they're comical, but they're also really campy.
Yes.
You know, like vampire movies.
Yeah.
And then you have like, you know, Christopher Lee as a vampire.
Yes. So, Hammer. I mean,
there's so many options in film and books and to light. I mean, and I loved Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, Spike. Forever.
So yeah, it's funny. I'm always like, I'm an Angel and a Stefan. And I'm always meeting the Spike and Damien? People who are like, which means we'll never fight over a guy together. That's great.
That's right.
Do you have a favorite? Would you have any favorite vampire books?
So I did really like Deborah Harkness's Discovery of Witches.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I like the world that she builds around, like, this, you know, for folks who haven't read it, there's like a genetic reason for witches and demons and vampires in the yes. world. And yeah. so I love the, like, the story she weaves around that. And because she's a historian of alchemy and all of that, like, just the world she builds is really interesting. So I think of more recent ones, that's probably my favorite, but mm-hmm. I mean, if someone said you could, you know, take one vampire novel to your desert island with you, it would probably be Interview with the Vampire.
That's a good one.
The one to take.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Which is probably stereotypical, but it was my first love.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also love that, as you were saying, like, there's so much room, and I think that for some people, the romantic vampires we're talking about maybe aren't their thing, but for them, there's Blade, mm-hmm. you know, which there's sort of the, and there's still, what was it? The Creepshow was where. I'm blanking. David Tennant is in it, but also
The remake of Fright Night.
Oh, sorry, Fright Night is the one yes. I'm thinking. David Tennant
so good. That's so good. Yeah.
What's his name as the vampire? He was Alexander the Great. I'm trying to remember his name. Oh, there's nothing worse than listening to someone on a podcast trying to remember something.
Okay. And then anyway. You can just hear people screaming it in the background.
Yeah, Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell, yeah. And Farrell. I loved the original Fright Night too. I mean, they're both actually really good in different ways. But David Tennant is just chewing scenery in that movie.
So
he's delicious.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I adore him anyway. So I was really excited to see him in that. But yeah, like, I think it's just, there's so many interesting ones. Like, probably one of my favorite ones. Oh gosh, what is it called? It's it came out about the same time The Lost Boys is, but it's like a really mm-hmm. gritty vampire movie. Is it Near Dark?
That sounds really familiar.
I can't remember the name of it. That's terrible. Yeah. Apparently we're just going to do that. Like talk about things. I can't remember the names.
There we go.
But it's like they, you know, they live in a car and they put foil on the windows.
Yeah.
It's like this really like not glamorous mm-hmm. view of vampires. Like, you know, Lost Boys is still kind of glamorous, even though they live in a like rundown house
skirts,
or cave.
The mullets
or,
and the,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, you know, late 80s, but, Is it Near Dark? I can't remember if that's what it's. Anyway,
the other one is
a really good one too.
Yeah, another one I think that for modern, like if someone wants like a really like a well-made film about with like great actors being vampires as opposed to anything cheesy is Only Lovers Left Alive with Hilda Swinton and Loki. What's his name?
Tom Hiddleston.
Hiddleston,
God. Yes. Yeah,
and Anton Yelchin's in that. It is like,
it's so beautiful.
What are these eternal beings? It's a very wild, it's a vibe kind of a movie. Like more about the vibe than like anything that happens, but it's really good.
Yeah. And it's just the cinematography in the movie. I mean, if you're a movie person, it is gorgeous. It's just a gorgeous movie. Yeah.
So the fun thing is if you're making a vampire tarot deck, you get to put like nods to these things here and there where it should never, I really do think that person reading the cards should not need anything except like yearbook and what's in front of them. So, but like, it's fun for like, so if the Nine of Pentacles is this beautiful woman at a piano with her, a bust that looks like her and like, you can read it with that. But if you're a vampire fan of like 80s films, you might know that's Catherine Deneuve's character from The Hunger. And that might add a new layer, but it won't, you know, you don't need to know that kind
of
thing.
Yeah. Talk about another good vampire movie.
God, so good.
So kind of like on the tarot side of things, like, you know, I do want to talk about The Little White Book because I think, you know, what you've done is beyond that idea of The Little White Book. I mean, those are very helpful, you know, too. But so what, you know, what do you think makes for a good companion book?
Oh, yeah. Tarot? So The Little White Book, if it's what's funny, I was talking to someone at Llewellyn, I think it's a little younger. And I asked if like a particular deck was going to have an LWB or a full book. And she was like, what's an LWB? And I was like, oh, which tells you that the modern, the tarot publishers have kind of overcome the issue of The Little White Book, which was that, okay, in the early, the late 90s, I don't know, the any time before the last 10 years, if you bought a tarot deck, it came with like a little white pamphlet and each card would have like 10 words. So it'd be like, enterprise, creativity, installment payments, you know, and then like, and you'd be like, what the heck does that have to do with anything? Mm-hmm. So for a long time, the rallying cry in the tarot world was throw out The Little White Book. You don't need it. Pure intuition only, you know, and that's what everyone did for a little while. And I think this largely has to do with like advancements in printing technology, which I think is something we overlook sometimes about what that means for us. But Llewellyn's guidebooks are full color, big companion books that contain a full page for every card. So it meant I still had a word count, which is the weird thing about like, it's writing a novel. I can go as long as I want, but I have a word count per card that I can't go too low or high from. And that allowed me to describe the scene, what I think is happening in the scene. Talk about, so if what the number and the suit element is going on, and then try and describe how you might apply this, what the essence of the card is and how you might apply it upright and reversed. And having that extra space, it's still not enough. It's still like, I would like be very, it would be very late at night and I'd be like struggling with a card. And I just wanted to like follow around every person who uses this deck and just answer questions for, because like you can't, I'm writing what a card means, but I can't know what you're going to ask about it. So like, the same description has to matter for like, should I order this item off the menu? You know, to what is my, I have this health crisis. What should I do? You know, that kind of thing. Those are very divergent ideas. So you still having to like write the essence of the thing, but you got to write expansively. And also here's a fun statistic. 8 out of 10 tarot decks purchased are someone's first deck. So, which means most people just have this, they just have your deck and the book that goes with it. So it has to be like a soup to nuts tarot practice in a book. And of course, all of us benefit from reading more and beyond and diverse perspectives on tarot and different the people who do prediction versus more self-help. Like these are all like wonderful things to get into, but the companion book itself should serve the reader and like that should be all that they need. So that is, that's a tall order, but it's a very reasonable order. I mean, it has to be that these days, I feel.
Yeah.
or else you just sort of like pull out your, a lot of people who bought tarot decks way back, they kind of pulled them out and they're like, oh, I don't get it. I don't know what this means. Maybe I'm not psychic. And they stopped. So with the guidebook, actually I have it in front of me. And then I got to do other things like talk about the history of the tarot briefly and talk about how to use it, kind of like just like 25 years of doing this, like little tips and tricks I picked up along the way, including like things that we didn't used to include in these books, like how do you shuffle cards? And you got to include a few spreads. And then I thought it would be great to have a ritual to bless the deck. And it's a very kind of like generic pagan, modern pagan ritual, but it's, it's generic so that you can make it yours and just something to do with the deck. So I feel like guidebooks have come such a long way.
Yeah. I was thinking, like you said, like, I think earlier deck, like I think about the first few decks I owned and they either had the little white book or they had like a full book you had to buy separately.
Yeah, exactly.
Cause I have a couple of those from books that are, you know, from decks that are out of print. And yeah, like they were much more expansive, but it was a big expense to buy like cards and then like a whole book.
Yeah.
Too, if you wanted the full whatever of the deck. So I do love this new kind of approach of having like really a full book in with the deck.
Yeah.
It's a set.
And having the full color card image is important because the art is so good. Like Craig's art is all these modern decks being like, there's such great art in them today. So this is not just exclusive to the vampires, but Craig did such a good job. And there's so many great little details. One of the things that we found a little challenging was that so most vampire fiction, the vampires aren't just walking around snarling with their fangs out. But in most tarot decks, there's just like, you know, like these big bangs moments. But so Craig did a great job of creating just like a little bit of a sensation of like, there's something wrong with their teeth, you know, like to create that fear. But you can really see things a little more clearly in the book, which you will have on hand maybe when you're reading the deck with the cards.
It's a bigger image than the card. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, I like that. And well, it's just nice too, I think, to have, like if you just wanted to read the book and, and you have the card, the image from the card there.
Yeah.
And I do think printing, you know, the advances in printing techniques means a lot because I think about the difference between borderless cards.
Yes.
And like older cards that all have a border.
Yes.
That sometimes almost takes away from the art.
Yes.
And then you have these, you know, newer borderless cards that are easier to print with like modern digital printing techniques.
Yeah. Isn't it? Because if anyone listening doesn't know, the bleed on printed cards, you know, there wasn't so precise. It was pretty good, but you couldn't guarantee that every single card was going to be exactly cut where you had planned it. So they had to have this like border around it so that they weren't cutting off the artwork. And now they've come a long way and you don't have to do that anymore. So I was happy that this deck doesn't have any borders.
Yeah, no, it's really, I like that. I participated in the Kickstarter for the British publishing house that's doing the Austin Osmond's Bear deck. I don't know if you've seen this.
Yes.
And like one of the issues they've had is that his cards were meant to touch each other. Like there's images that go across cards. So they are dealing with borderless cards and the bleed has to be perfect because they're supposed to mesh.
Yeah.
And so it's been really a challenge for them to print these cards because he just drew them by hand. It was his personal deck.
Yeah.
So
that's wild. And that is one of those things, like if it's not quite right, you're going to notice it.
It'll drive you crazy. Yeah. Like that little offset. Yeah. We, so my husband and I were in a little publishing house, which folks who listen to the show probably know. And we just got a box of books from the latest book that we published and we're print on demand. So like you never know what you're going to get when you open a new box of books.
Yeah.
And the first book we pulled out, the spine is crooked. Thankfully the rest of them look okay. But that first one, I was just like, yeah. So, and they're pretty good. I mean, we work with Ingram and they're pretty good about replacing ones if they show up and they're just bad. So
yeah.
But yeah, the printing thing is a whole different level of stuff.
Wow. And where I know that like cardstock is such a question mark, you know, for everybody now. And like people, I noticed that independent tarot creators kind of got the idea that they needed the thickest cardstock imaginable. So sometimes you get these independent card decks and they're like planks of wood. Mm-hmm. And then then of course I watch YouTubers, they'll be like, oh, this card is too flippy. Look, it's just flying around. And I'm like, but when you shuffle cards, they need to have a bit of that bend.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to have a natural bend. If you use a tarot deck, we'll develop that over time.
Yeah.
And it's just funny to me that like, that's always a conversation, and the Llewellyn, one of the things for them about the where they print everything has to do with the having the box have that magnetic closure, which is so so sexy. So
yes, I do like this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I have a practice like in the morning for my morning pages. I like choose a deck for the month. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's Oracle deck and sometimes it's tarot deck. And then I just pull card every morning. And that's kind of the impetus for my morning pages before I start writing.
Nice.
And so I have a round deck, the Daughters of the Moon deck from the 70s, 80s, 90s, depending on when you encountered it. And I have some issues with it because it's very essentialist about women. I mean, there's some things about it, like, that aren't, I'm not crazy, but the art is this very kind of folk art. You know, they're really brightly colored. And I hate shuffling them though, because they're round.
They are. They're a beast. So I have that. I had the black and white version that you're supposed to like paint yourself, but I don't know. That and the mother piece were into this round thing. And I know one of the ideas there was that, if I remember with the mother piece, the idea that being seen like upright and reversal is a very patriarchal male idea.
Right.
And
so you could have tilted or.
Yeah. I've met like two people who use the tilt of it in any significant way. Everyone else just sort of adjusts it. One of my mentors did like the whole, like, if it's tilted this way, that's more of an internal, they act this way, it's more external kind of thing.
Yeah. I've never done like a full spread with them or they've just always kind of been like individual cards for me. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think that's part of it is that, hey, they're really big. So they take up a lot of room.
Yeah, they do.
And that's another thing too. I think they're just a little bit too big to shuffle, like in my hands, they're a little bit too big. And I do appreciate cards that are like human person size.
Yes. Yes.
Shuffle. So
yeah. Absolutely.
Do you have a favorite deck? I mean, other than the ones you've participated in, obviously.
Yes,
do you have a favorite deck?
You know, it's funny. Sometimes you mentioned earlier with Vampire, like your first love. My first tarot deck was not this one, but Secret Tarot by Nizzoli. It's a Los Carabeo deck. That was the one that I was using when I really got serious about tarot. And I my first copy of that, I read that in all over campuses and bars and cafes in the forest, you know, and it looks a certain type of way. And I use another copy of it now. But that deck, I think the useful answer here is it's mainly because I associate that deck with my experience of learning the cards. I also got to say the Steampunk Tarot by Barbara Moore is one. I'm friends with Barbara, but so go ahead. You were saying.
Oh, no, it's just beautiful. I love that deck. I don't have it, but I've seen the artwork and it's gorgeous.
It's beautiful. And what I love about it is I think, okay, sometimes you get a themed tarot deck and the theme is sort of like, I'm just going to make, I don't know, if we had the Tarot of Narwhals, right? And you would, it would just be the Rider-Waite-Smith with, like, little narwhals instead of people. But that, it's based on the Rider-Waite-Smith, but the mechanics of steampunk and the aims of steampunk and the ideas about steampunk are in the cards, in the art. Like, the theme isn't just icing, you know? It's serving that. And so I know for Tarot of the Vampires, we wanted that to also be the same thing, where it's not just, it's the Page of Cups, but she's a vampire. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to think about, this is a weird word to use, but mechanically, what are all of the things about vampires, their powers, their weaknesses, all of that. And then where is that in the Rider-Waite-Smith? Mm-hmm. So you have a thing like, so just for me, one of the weirder ones for me was the Eight of Cups is like the moment of like leaving something behind and it's following a different path. And that, for me, that kind of lined up with vampires losing their reflections. So I had like in the card it has like a beauty queen vampire who has lost her reflection and is having to like choose something different. But there's that moment. It's like, it's a painful moment for her, mm-hmm. which is something like, I think usually some Eight of Cups make it seem like it's a very easy choice. And I don't think it is. So anyway, all this is all just to say that like a theme deck, the theme should be serving the reader mm-hmm. to grasp and the wisdom and so that your familiarity with it, like, oh yeah, vampires turn into mist. This is kind of like being sneaky, you know, that kind of thing, as opposed to just for show. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's, and so like some steampunk things are like, it's a lady and she's got gears on her dress, you know? And so for me, The Steampunk by Barbara Moore is an amazing. I also just wanted to come in for landing on it just to say, it's one of those decks where steampunk is not very emotional. It's in the head. Mm-hmm. And that deck is just very clinical. Not just, I don't mean like my feel of it, but like the actual mm-hmm. art, it's very clinical. It's like people doing, creating things and things work or they don't. And that's useful in a lot of situations, especially work situations where you just want to read about like, what should I do? And you don't mm-hmm. want to get caught up in the emotions of it. Yeah. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, no, that makes sense. It's an interesting take on it. I was just thinking like the theme should serve the reader. And I was thinking mm-hmm. about like, I've been given decks, you know, over time, because people know I like tarot cards and whatever. And two decks that I have been gifted, I had to pass along to other people because I could not work with them. Mm. And they both swapped swords for guns.
Oh, yeah.
But I just found them aggressive mm-hmm. to the point that I just didn't enjoy the cards.
Yeah. Because that is a very different, it's a very different vibe. There's one card that has the gun in it in the mm-hmm. vampires where it have like a security, like, or like they're like bodyguards or something. But the point of it is that the vampire moves too fast and she's not in danger.
Yeah. It's very Matrix. Like the card's very Matrix, which I like.
Yeah. Yeah. For that. And like, it's also very like, that one to me is like the most Vampire the Masquerade, and mm-hmm. the punk kind of vampire.
Yeah.
But I think that you do have to, as a matter of fact, just here's a wacky secret. Our mutual friend Benabel really helped me with that card. Originally showed like police officers holding their guns out. And Benabel, who I like ran some of the images past, was like, oh no, hang on. Like, this was right when like police trials were going on and I had not made that connection. So I think the tarot, this is just to say, tarot deck creators have to think about like to like an obnoxious level, kind of all every detail about the card, because how could someone take it? So that people do not need to see cops pointing guns at them in their when they're reading, when they're just trying to read, ask a tarot question. Yeah. But the same thing with how people use diverse characters, how LGBTQ people show up, how people of different sizes show up. I only have one plus size vampire in the deck, but it was important to have one. And also because I guess most modern vampire people, plus size vampires, usually like a body horror thing I didn't want to get into, but recognize that like we could go beyond that.
Vampires are, I mean, they show up and I think there's one in the Deborah Harkness books. There's one.
Yes. But often they're like made fun of or mm-hmm. So I needed to make sure that for that example is the Queen of Pentacles. She had to just exude comfort and not have mm-hmm. it be about her size, like other than like she's just
kind of lush, like she just has this lushness about her.
Yeah, it's not she's really, drinking her Bloody Mary.
I like that card too. I feel like we could talk about this forever. There's just so many aspects of both tarot and vampires that it's fascinating. But we try to keep it to an hour.
Oh, yeah.
So before we play our game of chance, I wanted to give you an opportunity to let people know where they can find more out about your work if you want to be found, and what's coming up for you. And like I said, this will air in January. So
this is in January. So hopefully by then I have an author website created. And also I've been wanting to I've been working on some YouTube content. It'll be under, I believe, the Tarot Quest. Is my YouTube channel. And if you find me on Twitter at the Tarot Quest. No, is that true? No, at Tarot Quest, Charles. Get it together. At Tarot Quest. If you send me a question, I will give you a free one card reading with the Tarot of the Vampire, so you can get a taste of it. As a matter of fact, so at the moment, I just completed a bunch of deadlines. And so I'm blissfully don't have anything ahead of me other than next in 2024. So this year, I worked on an Oracle deck based on Dante's Inferno for Los Garibaldi.
Wow, that sounds awesome.
I've worked on a lot of dark things before, and I'm kind of the goth writer for Los Garibaldi, but this is the darkest. Like, there's cards of people on fire. There's cards of people being eaten by snakes. And I remember thinking, like, an Oracle deck is usually how you start your day. You describe your practice with it.
Yeah.
So this was an intense one, but people love that. It's a beautiful poem, and I got to reread it and experience it again. So there's that coming out. And also the 2025 tarot calendar by by Llewellyn. Excuse me. I got to write, which is like the tarot calendar is like 12 mini essays, similar to the witch's calendar, if you've ever seen that one. And so that's been really fun to just think of, like, what are 12 like original spreads or different things to think about tarot
with the month and
exactly.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I like it. Awesome. So on the subject of dark things, I guess.
Yes.
I have joked on the show, and if you've listened to the episode, you probably said, like, you know, my initial idea for the show was to talk about stuff we're not supposed to talk about, which somebody had already taken. So I made a game out of it at the end. So I will roll a die, and depending on what number I get, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, money, or politics.
Okay.
And if I roll six, you get to pick which one you want.
Okay.
And it's about your work. And I mean, I try not to just like give you a gotcha. Like, it's about stuff we've talked about or stuff that's shown up in your work. So it's not just like, you know, what happens when we die, Charles?
Oh God, I spent a lot of time thinking about that.
Hey, I'm a Scorpio, like this wired in my brain. So.
Yes.
So for politics, how you feel about that?
Politics, and specifically within the work.
Okay. So we kind of, we touched on this about like the sexuality of vampires and their gender presentation, but you know, vampires live long enough in folklore or reality, wherever you are with vampires.
Sure.
to see the political pendulum swing like very differently than people with who live shorter lives. Right.
Yeah.
So, what, you know, politics and vampires, like,
so much.
I feel like this is a little bit underutilized in vampire fiction. It shows up in Deborah Harkness, which I really appreciate.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons I like her books. But
yeah,
what are we missing here?
Yeah, no. So politics and vampires, such a thing. I think there's a quote. I think it's from Deborah Harkness, but correct me if I'm wrong. But there's a quote that, like, okay, no, it might be Laurel K. Hamilton, who wrote the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series, which is that, like, most conspiracy theories are ridiculous because it would take way too much time and resources to ever do anything with this, except vampires have time and resources to do these things. So the vampire as shadow government idea shows up in some fiction. And I think it was really influenced strongly by the Vampire the Masquerade role-playing game we've talked about a couple times. Mm-hmm. But vampires speak to our fears, and one of the fears we have is that there's someone else running this show. Who is this cabal? Is it like the
Illuminati?
The Illuminati. Yeah. And so it's fun to play with that in vampire fiction. And you get to decide. One thing people love to do is decide which people in history were vampires, you know, like Rasputin or something like that. And so in the tarot deck, the Suit of Pentacles is all about, of course, like the Suit of Pentacles in tarot is about, material things, wealth, but also hard work, you know, to get these things. And so when I was like playing around with what is this world? Cause you have to do world building to create a tarot deck. My world building was that I call them the Eternal Order, and their seal conveniently is a pentacle with a vampire skull on the front of it. And it represents vampires sort of supremacy over all, because the pentacle or the pentagram symbol represents, of course, like all of the elements together, the human body and everything like that. So vampires, like if you're a couple hundred years old and you're broke, like look at your life, right? Look at your choices.
You have compound interest on your side.
Yeah. And so what are the things that they care about? And like, so sometimes in some vampire fiction, it's just them ruling, and it's just them having subjects. But I think other vampire fiction has played around. It's something I've enjoyed, the Castlevania animated show, which I think also dovetails into like the game series, plays into like, well, what do vampires actually want to do? And it might be to ferment war, you know, like to get so that there's lots of that humans aren't safe, you know, because they're always killing each other. So there's lots of death. So I think, so I guess like I would, vampire writing fiction, it's usually like there's like a council, and sometimes there's a head of the council, and there's like this idea that they're all, I'm just gonna use the word, like bloodthirsty and at each other's backs, and they're all doing conspiracies. But I like whenever vampire fiction can play with like, what do they care about? And is it, sometimes it's just being left alone and being protected. And I think True Blood did a really good job. I didn't read the books, but the TV series, I think, did a really good job of playing with this idea of what did the Vampire Council want, and how does it, politics also gets into like, how do we police ourselves? And they got into that, like they're trying to mainstream in that series. And so it was very important that they stop their own people from stepping out of line. Does that make any sense? Did I cover this?
No, it does
this?
Make sense. And that shows up in the Deborah Harkness books too.
Yes.
The need for secrecy and policing themselves and how to like cover up stuff when it happens. And, you know.
That. Yeah. I think there's like an awareness of people that we can't have full transparency for any, you know, for anything. And I think, so if there's not full transparency, then there's people who know things you don't. And who are those people? And who do they care about? And like, ooh, like that question keeps us up at night and makes us really great vampire fiction about ruling bodies and things like that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, okay. So you did not get the death question, but I'm going to just, and you can just answer this yes or no.
Sure.
And let people think about it. Because I do want to ask you. So if you were offered the turn, if someone came to you and said, Charles, I can make you a vampire, yes or no?
God, there's a great line for, so in Christopher Moore, when Jody finds out she's been turned, she's like, I was 10 pounds away from my goal weight. So like, would I turn today, or can I get a month to like be on a treadmill with a personal trainer? Would I do it? I'm doing
it. Does it make you like,
I'm doing it.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm doing it.
It's funny. It's like, you know, my instinct is yes. And then I also think about like, you know, Giles and Buffy and like the Talamasca and Anne Rice. And I was like, I'm probably really those people.
Yeah.
But
Watchers Council. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I am probably the nerd, not the vampire, but maybe.
So. Yeah. I'd probably be a familiar, to be honest with you. I'd be like a Renfield going out and getting the mail and going to the DMV for them.
Not seeing the new movie with Nicolas Cage.
Okay.
But I want to. Okay. I have not seen it yet.
Do we have a moment for like one brief thing about that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay. I wrote about this in the book. Bram Stoker is the perfect 1897 cultural shadow for the British and American public. He's an imperialist conqueror who brings tainted earth into their countries and messes with their women, which is what we did. So I love that what the metaphor is always updated. In The Invitation, he's the new metaphor is he's the white knight, you know, guy who's actually like a terrible anti-feminist. But then, Nicholas Holt and Nicolas Cage, vampire, Dracula's a narcissist. And Renfield has found himself in a group for people who are dealing with toxic relationships and narcissists. I think it's the perfect metaphor because we're all obsessed with narcissists today. And we're like always diagnosing everybody we don't like as being a narcissist. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, why is that our shadow? Because social media has made us a little has opened the door for us to be way more narcissistic than maybe we were before. So I think that metaphor really is the updated Dracula for this time.
There you go. Perfect. What a great place to wrap things up. So awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a delight.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenankar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.